Welcome to another CaperCast. With Joe Farinaccio's help, we recently recorded a great gab on the telephone with a long-term acquaintance of mine, a Mr. Lee Bullock. Lee was, I think, the first guy to establish a full-service multi-hull boatyard. And he chose to do it in the real hotbed of the early multi-hull period in America, there at Sausalito, California. Now, Lee comes on in a rambling stream of consciousness, and I think we need to hear it because it's a great example of the boundless enthusiasm, the confidence, the willingness to risk that typified the advent of the early modern multi-hull. Please bear in mind that Sausalito in the 1980s was still recovering from having been a shipyard during World War II. When I was first there in the 1950s, it was still 2 miles of junk all along the waterfront. And it had been improved substantially by the time Lee arrived in the 1980s, but there were still several old big marine railways. And some of these railways had been there since long before the war. Now there was a landowner, a guy named Zach Krikorian, who made his fortune with a waterfront bar. So he had let the railways to a tenant who was trying to make a living hauling out boats. And Lee came along with the idea that he could haul out multi-hulls. So we'll pick up the story where Lee is telling how all that happened.
Unofficially, we started on the third rail with the first cradle at Sausalito Marine Ways. We did that. I think I hauled my little 36-footer that I was living on, a Lodestar. We did that probably in 78, and got a relationship with Harry Thompson, the guy that was running it, a tugboat guy, a great guy. And that led into three more cradles, and finally he ended up giving me the keys and saying, go for it, because every time you pull a multi-hull, my rent goes up, so you might as well do it. And he gave me the keys to the whole thing, and that was two big cradles, and then my three cradles on the third rail. So we were we kicked it in gear officially with a business license and everything in 1980, and ran all the way up through 1988. And when I got in there, people had just abused it, and they knew it was going down. There was a lot. All the pilings had rotted at high water, low water, you know, Mark. And multi-hulls are big, but they're not heavy. So I got down in the mud and split some 55-gallon drums and wrapped the areas that were rotted on the pilings that I needed to pull these boats, and filled them with cement and patched them, and then started hauling boats.
Wow. That's taking the bull by the horns.
Yeah, down in the mud, man, down in the mud, and rising out of the ashes, literally out of the mud. But, it was quite the thing. We got going, and I was trying. I thought BAMA was going to be, Bay Area Multi-Hull Association, was going to be my meat and potatoes. And I went over and told them that they finally have a place to come and complete authorized service with the designers and builders. And Tom Blackaller and I, the America's Cup skipper, redid the marina to hold up to 30 multi-hulls. Jim saw that when he came for the event.
Yeah.
And we had chandlery service. We had three rails for long-term on top, you know, short-term projects, and then, you know, turn them and burn them in and out, haul-outs on the third rail, on the third cradle. They were underwing lifts. I separated the axles from the old days because they were all tied together. Then we only needed two with some uprights and a beam, so we lifted them from under the wings. So the entire boat was suspended, because that's, you know, the strongest part of any multi-hull is the cross arms. So we didn't want to keel haul them. Everybody else was trying that and couldn't do two in a row without screwing one up. So we did, we got it. The first year was about 50 or 60, and then we averaged pretty much 100 haul outs a year, and every kind of multi-hull you could possibly think of came through. And it was like the ER. They always came to me with what didn't work, you know. So through the 10 years I did that, I learned about everything you're not supposed to do and what doesn't work. And that was quite an education that carried me through what I'm doing now.
Well, okay, let's hold that. Well, let's not get to what you're doing now. until we get to what you've been doing in the meantime.
Yeah, South City Multiholes was amazing. I mean, not only in a spiritual way, because back in the day when I was in high school, I didn't know this, but I looked at my annual and everybody's wishing me good luck with the boat, and when I get a boat, call them and all that. So I evidently was, you know, had everything spread out on my mom and dad's floor in high school. And what was there was two hulls and two girls by Jim Warham.
Oh, yeah.
And the Sea Runner Construction Manual with Joe Hudson's Ballad of Zachary Bone. I had study plans for Warham Tangaroa that I was playing with, as well as the Sea Runner 31. And I'm doing all this in Colorado in college and high school. I'd never even been on one. And so it all started. And all my mentors back then ended up coming through Sausalito Multiholes in one way. In fact, Jim's partner, when they were kids, after they met Art Piver, he became one of my foremen in my yard. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, talk about, it was like riding a rainbow, you know. It just goes to show you.
You're speaking of Dick Homestead?
Yeah, Dick Homestead and you and Don Cugat, the broker. He was my broker at Sausalito Multiholes.
Yeah.
The guy that introduced you to Piver.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So all of a sudden, here we are, you know. And Jim came out for... We had a big event when we launched the first cat for Dennis Connors. At that point, we were all released from the non-disclosure agreements we signed. So everybody decided to come up to Sausalito and talk about it, because we usually have an anniversary party, my birthday and the unofficial anniversary of the boatyard. And all of a sudden, how many did we have? We had like 40 different multiholes that sailed in. We had 20 in the marina. I had railroad wheels for moorings out in the harbor, so we spiderwebbed them out there, you know, side-tied them, and we get four or five in one row. And all the rock and roll guys came down that used to sail with me and did the music. We had the circus tent, and it just exploded. And instead of a one-bushel bag oyster party, we wiped out Johnson's Oyster Ranch over 3 days. And Tom Blackhaller was my partner, so he was the MC. I mean, it was just incredible, because 20 years before that, I was sitting on the floor in Denver, Colorado, worshiping these people, including Jim. And all of a sudden, here we are. And it was just a very spiritual thing. I mean, my mom and dad, when they came out for it, they couldn't believe it, because they saw me on the floor with all this stuff all spread out everywhere.
Well, Lee, let's back up a little bit here, and let me ask you about, you were talking about Dennis Connors' America's Cup boat. That at that point, you were working in San Diego, were you?
No. I was still in Sausalito, but the crew, you know, all the boys, like old man Morelli's son, Gino,
uh-huh.
and Bob DeLong, and, you know, the Hobie guys were doing the R&D. So we were all just coming and going, doing our own part in the whole thing.
But that was right after they built the Stars and Stripes. That was it.
That was the Stars and Stripes for the Deed of Gift Challenge that New Zealand put forth. Yeah.
Yeah, the first multi-hull to win the America's Cup.
That's correct. They had two of them. Bob built two of them. We had the Dave Hubbard, who was at the event. You remember that? We built that event as from then until now. And we took all the old school guys that could get out there, Jim and Dave Kuyper and Don Cugat and all the guys that started this stuff in the early days, and put them with the new guys that were doing the America's Cup Cat. And it was quite a deal. But we were up and down the coast. And at the same time that Dennis Connors had everybody jamming on that cat to defend the cup, actually it was two cats, and Tom Blackhaller was working with R.J. Reynolds and started the Salem Pro 40s, which was a syndicated race based on like a NASCAR format of promotion and stuff.
Yeah, Pro Sail.
Pro Sail, yeah. Pro Sail, yeah. The Salem Pro 40s.
Yeah.
So it was quite the deal. We had all of the heavyweights of the time doing the same thing for the two opposing groups that hated each other. You know, I mean, Dennis and Tom did not get along. So it was really weird that we're the central pool for all information regarding what they wanted to do.
Wow. God. Now, and again, let's put us in time. That must have been like 1980-something?
Yeah, he started in 87 with all the stuff down there. And Tom started, he figured if he was going to do that down there, well, he was going to start something up there. Because we got him on the first Formula 40, first catamaran multi-hull he'd been on, and he never looked back. I mean, he was done. And it was 88 was when the race was, and the launching of the boat and our party that Jim came to out there was in June of 88. Before they
that's the party you're talking about, June me? That's the party I came to?
Yeah.
88.
June of 88.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'll never forget that. Boy, I met I don't know how many people were there, but I met a lot 5,000
people.
That I had
5,000 people
before.
Yeah, 5,000 people a day walked through there, including all the media, including international media. We were it was the first time anybody heard anything about the cats in specifics.
Yeah.
And Tom was good, boy. He asked all the right questions, you know. And you guys, I was kind of thinking, boy, he's getting tough on those guys up there. And but you guys all handled it really well. I mean, it was so, and people appreciated understanding what this was all about because they really hadn't heard. And
but
then having all the boats,
some real heritage, like Lauren Williams was there.
My buddy Williams, yeah.
He was a high school kid when Arthur Piver hired him to draw plants.
He was the draftsman.
He was taking a course in mechanical drawing in high school when Piver hired him to draw plants because Piver said, "Oh, everybody that sees my plants says they were drawn by some drunk." So I got this kid in here. And Lauren Williams turned out to be a gifted designer in his own right. And
that's right.
Also at that party, sitting with Lauren was David Kuiper. I had never met David before.
Oh, he's a hero for me. He was one of my heroes. I couldn't believe he came.
About David Kuiper.
Well, David back, what was it, 63, I think. He took a Piver, what was that, an AA, I think, and put hydrofoils on it. He designed a grid that flipped down under the boat between the main hull and the out hulls at the main crossarm and had another one off the stern of the main hull that had the rudder in it. And it was like an egg crate hydrofoil, old school, because, you know, there was no carbon fiber was not around.
Ladder foils.
Yeah, ladder foils.
Yeah.
And he went out, and he was out running speedboats, the ferries, and everything. And when he got up on foils, they had a hard time filming it because he'd leave the powerboats behind. And he did a video, and I lost it in a typhoon. But what an astounding thing back then. And I think he actually sailed that to Hawaii.
Well, he did more than that. He went out to Hawaii and back and then went out to the South Pacific and back. And there's a video about all of that on YouTube. David Kuiper, no, Kuiper.
Kuiper. Kuiper.
Yeah, and the name of his boat was Willawa.
Willawa, yeah.
And if any of the listeners would like to dig up that video and look at it, he performed something on hydrofoils in the 60s that was so unbelievable that nobody believed it.
Yeah,
nobody really paid attention to what he had achieved at that time. And at that party that you're talking about in 88, when I was sitting there with the guys, I remember David saying to me, "I can't imagine making my trips without the foils." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because when we were flying, it was so much more comfortable.
And more efficient fast. It was much faster."
Well, ladder foils are not really fast compared to today's hydrofoils, but ladder foils have the great advantage of being able to lift a lot of weight from low speed.
And it's safer because it's in closer to the main hull as compared to the carbon fiber foils that we use on the outhulls now.
And way out there, but the thing is that I rather expect that ladder foils may come back because the trouble with hydrofoiling is that the boats spend too much time not flying
in light
airs.
That's
and
right.
Ladder foils is a solution to that. You can get
because
them
it lifts in light air.
Yeah, huh? Get them up there. For commercial applications, I think ladder foils may come back. But, you know, the rage these days is T-foils and all these J-foils and L-foils and all that stuff that they're messing with. But David Kuiper did it at a time when nobody believed that he could do that. You know?
That's correct. And when we showed that film that night after the last day when we all gathered up over there at the restaurant, we did the film.
Yeah.
I never forget Gino Morelli, who was the lead designer on the Big Cats for Dennis. He was astounded. He had no idea that went down like that. Neither did Mickey Minos or the Smythe team that built the sails. And Hubbard came over, and they really drilled Dave as far as how he did that and without carbon fiber and yada, yada, yada. I mean, it was fantastic time for me because all my heroes were there. And, Dave was – it was really good to see you guys, Jim, Cugat, Brown, Cugat, Dave Hubbard, and even Mickey Minos. He'd been around with Hobie.
Yeah.
He was, they were gluing inner tubes together to make the first O'Neill wetsuits. I mean, it goes so far back, that they all came up to share and expose what was happening with the industry through Dennis. And it was just a very phenomenal event. I don't think there's been that many multi-hulls in one place since Polynesia. I mean, it was really something.
I don't know, man. You should go to the harbors in the Mediterranean now, Lee. I mean,
all the charter boats, all the charter cats,
and privately owned boats. I mean, it's just one multi-hull after another, particularly in the Med and particularly in Hawaii and many places in the Caribbean now. It's a preponderance of multi-hulls.
Yeah, they got the RVs on hulls now for the charter guys. And but when I got down there to do the working with Gold Coast and Rich and Roger.
It's about down there now. What are you talking about?
Oh, never mind. Well,
no.
I went down there to day boats with Gold Coast. Got hit
down
by Hurricane Hugo. St. Croix.
St. Croix, Virgin Islands. Okay. And
Gold Coast yacht. That was in 1988. That was right after event. The Sausalito Multi-Hulls, I've been working for 10 years to get a 5-year with 2 5-year options so I could get flooring loans to bring in new boats because I was recycling old boats owner to owner. That's how the yard stayed open. And we wanted new boats. And we had everybody lined up and a good ground-based lease guy that had Wind Warrior, fastest cat on the West Coast at the time. And he was trying to get his ground-based lease. But after that event, the lawyers got to my landlord, and I learned a lesson. Protect the landlord. Never assume he knows how to protect himself.
Oh.
And so they got to him and found out, that 5,000 people going through this 1890 boatyard, if you'd have fallen off the crane, you'd own that yard.
Yeah, we got to explain that. And I climbed the crane that night to take a picture of this whole shittery. And I don't know what happened to the picture, Lee. I'm so sorry.
My mom was freaking out. She's watching you up there, and she's going, you got to do something. I go, hey, this is Jim Brown. I'm not going to say anything to this guy. Are you kidding me? I've been in his shadow for 20 years. You think I'm going to tell him not to do something?
Well, I had done a lot of climbing in big, tall rigs by that time. I wasn't afraid of it. But geez, what an event that was. I met many of my clients that I'd never met before, including one woman, Joyce Clinton, who for years had a Sea Runner 40 trimaran and sailed it mostly in the Sea of Cortez and out to Cocos Island, did a lot of diving with her buddy, a guy named Terry, who was a former Navy SEAL. And when this was before Joyce had met Terry, and she had some other guy with him. And I said, Joyce, geez, I haven't seen you in a long time. How are you doing? What's going on? And she said, "Oh, I've been going through men."
Yeah, really.
Really a great fox lady and a very serious multi-hull person. Her boat was always immaculate.
They came out of the woodwork, boy. I mean, they started sailing in when they heard about it. And you got to realize, this thing only manifested itself in about 3, maybe 4 weeks. I mean, the whole thing popped in 4 weeks. No permits, no fire, nothing. And the city just said, "Okay, we'll straighten it out. You keep going, don't stop." And I was flying by the seat of my pants, and all of a sudden there it was. It just happened, but it was a lot of fun, especially seeing all the people that were in that what I call the third wave. I mean, Art and Gil's Catamarans and Rudy and Hobie and all those guys, that was the first wave with Art and everybody. And then the second wave was you guys with Cross and Newick and Horseman. And, you know, by the way, out of all the designers and builders that I talked to, which was, you know, any boat that came in, we found more information about it to see if there was any retrofits or mods that the designer suggested. But Ed Horseman was the only one that always called me Collect.
Yeah, Ed was a hard guy, but he meant well. Ed and I finally made friends. You know, we were toe-to-toe competitors for years.
He was touchy about stuff.
Yeah.
He had a chip on it. A lot of those first, second waivers had chips on their shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, with Art
we
going out
trying to grab off a piece of each other's market share, which was a bad mistake. And finally, Charles Quixote and those people from Canada, Jillian and Pat McGrath, put together the first World Multi-Hull Symposium. Well, it was at that time that Horseman and I finally got together And in fact, all of us designers, there were 10 designers. They brought us in from all over the world, and most of us had never even met each other.
Yeah, that would have been good.
And we said, okay, hey, it's time to quit backbiting. Now let's get together and sell multi-hulls. If somebody comes to you and wants a boat of such and such a description and you haven't got it, send it to one of us that does.
Yeah, and collaborative.
And all of a sudden, everything changed And so did Ed Horseman. Ed Horseman turned out to be a cool dude after that. It was all right.
Yeah, I was riding a rainbow, you know, calling everybody, talking to people, and all the people that I read about for, you know, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing. Don't let anybody ever tell you that if you have a vision and you can dream it, you can do it.
Well, okay, what was your dream after you lost your lease there at Multihulls, at the Sausalito Multihulls?
Right.
And then what? What in the world?
Well, I was, you know, obviously, you know, that thing had been 10 years in planning and dreaming and 10 years of operation, expecting a lease, and I'd get an eviction package.
Uh-huh.
And within about 4 days when the word got out, I lost all my tools. They stole my bicycle, and I figured, damn it, man, you know, I need to explain what's happening here, because nobody will understand if I just bail. So I called the most important was the guy that I owed the most money to, which was Gold Coast, because they were building a boat called Chaminade to bring to the bay so we could day charter, and we could sell Gold Coast boats. And all of a sudden, I'm evicted. But they had a waiting list, so they said, don't worry about it. And this is the first call I made. The first people I talked to to tell them this is not going to work anymore was Gold Coast. They said, look, you need to not let this get to you, because there was four of us, and we tried what you did for about a year and a half, 2 years, and we couldn't do it. We backed off to just building. So
Now. You're talking about Roger Hatfield and Rich DeFede.
Right.
Gold Coast Yacht, St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right. And they had the best day boat going, and they knew what they were doing. And I'd seen several of them, and we agreed that the bay would be an open market for them. And so we set it in motion, you know, on the premise that we were going to get a long-term lease. So when I told them that, they said, no, you can't let this get to you. Don't even think about it. Just get on a plane and get down here. Because as near as we can tell, you've been inside – underneath and on top of more different kinds, more varieties of multi-hulls than anybody alive. We can use you. And that was my first call. And then the rest of them wanted my head on a stake. It was incredible. So I ended up going down to St. Croix and working with them until Hurricane Hugo hit, which just completely wiped out the island. I mean, normally an eye of a hurricane, peak winds, you know, 20, 30 minutes as it goes over. Well, Hurricane Hugo hit about 10 o'clock on September 19th, and it stayed until about 5 in the morning. And there was never less than 3 tornadoes going on the inside of the wall. So it sucked the grass out of the ground. I mean, our complex, Judas Fancy, there in St. Croix, where I was staying, there was probably 30 houses. And when we walked out next morning at dawn, and it was still blowing 100, 110, and there's nothing. Every house is gone. It was just a slab with pipes. Huh. And we had double walls of red brick, and that made it, but we lost our roof. So it was really horrendous. And about a month after that, Peter Baker on Heavenly Days won a 50-passenger day sailboat for Lime Tree on St. Thomas, called me and said he needs some help, and I was there the next day. And we went over there, and I got into sailing these big boats.
Oh, yeah, as a skipper on the catamaran.
A skipper, mate, I didn't care. I lost everything once in a fire in Belvedere when I got out there and got on the boat. I lost everything when I got evicted. And then the hurricane took everything else. And I'm thinking, what is it? What's getting, where's your juice? And it's sailing. So when Peter called, I just jumped. And I lived on the boat for about a few weeks until I got a house. And at that point, I said, look, man, this is just, I got to do this. And if I was sailing Heavenly Days, and we were going out usually 6-7 days a week during season, that's 30, 40, 50 people at 9, another 30 or 40 at 1, and then another 30 or 40 at sunset for the sunset deal. So I just said, I'm not stopping. And I think I sailed pretty much almost 2 years and never missed a day. I would go on Spirit of St. Christopher, a big sprunk, or coconuts. I just bounce around and make sure that I got out every day.
This is all out of St. Thomas.
All out of St. Thomas at that time.
Yeah.
So that was what happened after the eviction. And, you know, people call me when the America's Cup started up there with the 72s, and they're going faster on the water than they are on the bridge. Everybody's calling me, you were 25 years ahead of the curve. Why did you leave? And I'm going, I wouldn't change anything, you know, because it took me a year down in the tropics, down in, you know, the Virgin Islands, to stop flinching when I got splashed. Because, you know, I mean, I love the wind. I mean, the 30 knots, 25 knots of wind every day under the bridge is great. But, you know, once you get your toes tanned and you're in white sand every day, it ain't that nice. I mean, it's
good
to wear.
You're talking about under the bridge, meaning the Golden Gate.
Golden Gate, yeah.
Yeah, and the water is cold. If you're in a boat in California, Northern California, you are cold. You know,
you're cold. 42-degree water, and you get splashed, you're cold all day, maybe 2 days.
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, so anyway, that was said. I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change anything. I mean, the rainbows that I've ridden with multi-hulls through all my stuff, it was just, you know, faithfully fearless and never saying no to a boat ride. I mean, that's pretty much all it takes.
Hey, I hope our listeners hear that. That's good. That was in the days of the can-do spirit.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Everybody was in it, not so much for the money, except, you know, the money buys another gallon of epoxy or a piece of plywood. It's not the objective. The objective, when you're following your passion, especially with multi-hulls, is just being there and doing it. It doesn't matter whether you're a millionaire or you're scratching for, you know, your next meal. But if you're doing it, the more you do it, the more you know. And it's just, follow your passion, whatever it is, because, well, I'll tell you, it works.
Well, okay, we're going to leave Lee Bullock there for the time being, because he's such a blast from the past that we've got to review a little bit, starting with a haul-out facility of full-service marine for multi-hulls in Sausalito in the 1980s into getting into building multi-hulls at the St. Croix, Virgin Islands, and then sailing these commercial so-called catamarans down in the St. Thomas. Those are the first three chapters in his remarkable career. And I think there are at least three more chapters, and we'll get to them one of these days, because I think he's just a great example of the frenetic enthusiasm that brought modern lightweight seafaring into being. And as I've said before, there are many individuals who have invested substantial portions of their lives into making this happen, and this is their story. Special announcement here. One such individual was my great friend Joe Hudson, whom I have just learned died just the other night, October 3rd, 2017. Many of you know Joe through his incredible cartoons. He's the guy that illustrated many of my publications. Next time we meet, if I can stay straight, I'll try to tell you a story about Joe. Okay, until next time, remember what Lee says, never pass up a good boat ride. Bye-bye.